You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Hello, hello, and welcome out there in podcast and YouTube land. You have reached a little ditty we call Johnny Has the Keys, a podcast where two friends get together. We talk about horror, science fiction, films, television, literature, all sorts of things, the key influences on those particular genres, and the things that they in turn influenced. If you're joining us for the first time, wow, great. Love the fact that you found us. Hope you like it. And whether you do or not, hope you like, comment, give us a review. The more you review, the more we stay on the lists, which means more people can find us, which is a great thing to have. And if you are returning, hey, you could give us a review too, because obviously you're returning for a reason, even if it's just a 3-sentence, hey, I like these guys, or whatever. Let us know. My name is David. I'm here with my co-host and partner in crime, Tim Smith. Tim, how are you? What have you been doing?
Oh my gosh, David, I am great, despite the fact that my subject for the week is not so great, although other people love it.
Interesting.
If we're going to jump into it, it is one of my favorite subgenres of horror. It is also, we discussed briefly, I think last week, Archive 81 was being a recent hit on Netflix at like number one. Well, this one's been number one too, but it is not as good as Archive 81, even though I like the subgenre. And that would be a long series actually called All of Us Are Dead.
All of Us Are Dead. That's the high school zombie, right?
It is. Okay. And it's one of those Netflix things that really kind of irks me. I don't have a problem with it being Korean. I love Korean zombie movies.
Oh, yeah.
And I love the premise.
Bong Ho? Isn't that the big Korean zombie guy? Bong Young Ho or whatever?
Oh, my God.
You know. Anyway.
I was going to say, you're close, but I could not confirm that without looking it up. This is one of those Netflix series, and they've already renewed it for a second season, that it's a great premise, but it just goes off into too many directions. And you start thinking, oh, it's the subscription mentality. More content means more to watch. And I'm like, they should have left this in the high school. The whole premise of a zombie outbreak in a high school is fantastic. But all the other little subplots and stuff bog it down tremendously. That being said, it's highly enjoyable and addictive. I couldn't quit watching it because I did want to find out what happened. But then I got to the 10th episode thinking, finally, it's over, and realized there's 12. God, was I pissed. I cannot believe there's more episodes.
Wow.
I think I told you that early on, it has a little bit of a problem trying to identify what genre it is. I was like, okay.
So is it like, hey, we're having an active shooter drill. Oh my God, there's zombies. Is it that kind? Is the school packed? I mean, is it a day?
The school is gigantic. It's a gigantic high school. Okay. It's like, you know, it looks like a college almost. Well, one of the problems with this is that they try to encompass everything into it, including the origin and eradication. So the origin, the whole thing happens in a science lab in the high school, and one of the teachers is the one that lets the thing loose, and this girl gets bitten by a test rat, and she ends up being like ground zero.
Okay.
And I know everyone out there in listener land, if you're going, shut up, you're spoiling it. No, I'm not, because you're going to have plenty of other things to latch on to, because this goes off in a million different directions. the zombie effects are great. They're your typical Korean zombie effect, where they're fast and rabid and make all those cracking noises. And like I said, there are some great, great gags, like, you know, them being stuck in a room and having to get to another level of the school and like putting a fire hose outside the window and having to climb outside the building. That kind of stuff is great. It's just all the other subplots with, you know, the parents of the children, the police, the government. There's just a lot going on in this show. So, Will I watch the second season? Probably not. Maybe the first episode just to see what they're trying to do again.
Well, that's interesting because it's this mentality of this subscription or binge mentality that, you know, I mean, I've said several times on the podcast, I'm kind of opposed to this sort of, even though huge proponent of Straczynski and loved Babylon 5 when it first came out and this, and still love it, but this whole arc storytelling was so new and innovative at the time. And now suddenly everybody has to do it. And it's the only way to do a series anymore. You can't tell one-offs. Everything has to be a season-long arc that's going towards something and yada, yada. And, you know, even listening in on writers' rooms and stuff they talk about, that's just lazy. It's just easy writing. Because instead of telling one complete beginning, middle, end story per week, you can just stretch that freaking story out for, you know, 6, 12, 18 episodes. And that sometimes might work, but usually doesn't. It usually just gets very distracting, or you're trying to fill in stuff. Or, like you said, you're getting into too many different inputs, and it's like, focus. You could have made this a trilogy instead of, you know.
This would have been a great, like, 5 or 6 episode thing.
Yeah.
Just taking place in the high school.
Yeah.
And I write in a series mentality because I publish on a subscription platform, but I try to encompass one story
right
in the main season, so to speak. And then if you have a similar character or two come cross over into the next season, that's great.
Sure.
But it's going to be a totally different story.
Yeah. That's the way it should be, ideally, rather than this stretch everything out sort of mentality. I went to the library a couple of weeks ago, and now they have the local library, and they have binge boxes, which I thought, what the hell? And basically what they've done is they've just curated, and they're grouping DVDs into like chick flicks, manly films, action adventures, you know, that sort of thing. But
it's like micro genres.
Yeah. And you rip them all together at the same time. And you have, you know, 2 weeks to watch them and bring them back or whatever. You know,
yeah.
And I was going, okay, yeah, I kind of get the curation. That's okay. But I think there's so much writing now that's just lazy writing on shows because we can stretch this out for 3 or 4 episodes. Doesn't matter.
Right.
Sort of thing.
And I mean, I'm a part of it. I mean, I don't contribute to it, but I write in the romance genre under a different pen name. And those are binge readers, and they crave it. And you cannot write stuff fast enough for them. And you can make money at it. But I try to elevate mine, at least. I don't, you know. I know that sounds frou-frou or whatever, but I try to do what would please me.
I try to make mine the best that they can possibly be.
I keep saying I'm cultivating my readers, you know. Hopefully they like what I'm doing because I'm not going to change.
Good.
You know?
I mean, I mean, use your voice. Make it yours. I agree with all that. Yeah, you can make money at it, but, you know, sideshow carnivals make money too. It doesn't mean they're good entertainment. So I'm just saying.
No, so that is what I was doing. I was over in the world of bloody Korean zombies.
Well, you do the new thing sort of thing, and I went back to the old thing, but I went to your genre.
You've been doing that a lot lately.
Yeah, I've been trying to jump over there a lot. So I went and revisited a couple of podcasts that do classics and do different film genres. And my cinephiles guys, I decided, okay, because I remember listening to one and they said they didn't like horror. So I'm going to look up all the ones that they've done that are horror because they intentionally do one every Halloween, right? So I went back and I listened to their take on The Exorcist, which we've already done, and their take on Nightmare on Elm Street, which we've already done. And it was just really interesting to listen to two people who admittedly don't like the horror genre.
Oh, so they were going to,
not because
I would be getting pissed off.
No, it's interesting because at first I thought, oh, they're going to be condescending, but it's not. It's not that they don't like it. It's that it genuinely scares them. they get afraid and can't handle it.
That's funny.
And so these are two grown men, you know, in their, you know, middle age.
You and I are so jaded.
Yeah. I know. And they're talking about how squeamish it is and, oh, I couldn't watch this part and, oh, this just made me so nervous.
Oh, she was standing in a body bag and a bunch of snakes at the bottom.
Oh, no. And it was just so interesting getting their takes on both of the films, you know. And they did a lot, you know, they pulled in a lot of the stuff, the same kind of stuff that we had researched too, like, you know, the tricks that Friedkin did off camera, you know, shooting the guns and whispering things to people, kind of not abusing the actors, but yeah.
Damaging Ellen Burstyn's spine.
Yeah, having the guy pull harder so it bothered her coccyx or whatever, you know. All of that stuff. But interestingly, and I wonder, this is why I bring it up, because I thought it'd be cool to pose to you. The one guy, John Morris, said this was his fourth time watching, like, The Exorcist, for example. And he said, ironically, this time it wasn't as scary because, of course, I knew where the jump scares were. I knew where the gross outs were, that sort of thing. He said, but by it not being scary, it made me appreciate how well the film was made because I wasn't distracted by personally being so scared. And it started me thinking, and your series is a good example. Do people tend to do horror movies because they're cheap and easy and they can get the scare and it makes some money? It's a one-off? You know, I mean, that's what Sam said. Sam and Rob said the reason they decided to do, you know, Evil Dead was because horror movies make money. And I just thought it was very interesting if that's an easier end than, oh, I'm going to do a science fiction film, or, oh, I'm going to do an action adventure, or, oh, I'm going to do a romance.
Yeah, I would think so. And the reason being is that it's easy to do horror low budget. You can't do sci-fi low budget.
Well, I also, what I was kind of getting at, and I really like that these two guys in this podcast brought it up. One guy said, because unlike a lot of other movies, yes, we do have a mindset. You know, we're going to an action movie. We kind of expect to see action. We kind of expect explosions. We kind of expect car chases. You know, a James Bond movie, we have in our mind what it's going to be like before we go in, before it starts. Horror is the same way. You know, and certain tropes build in a certain way, which means, okay, if you're watching a realistic modern day movie, it's a horror movie. You know it's a horror movie. If they start talking about werewolves, you, as an audience member, go, werewolves are real. To these people, they may not think so. They may say no. They may say there is no such thing as a zombie. But you know there will be a zombie in this movie because it's a horror movie. And they're saying it doesn't exist. And I was going, right. Okay, that is so true. We do, you know, he said a great example. He said, okay, in The Exorcist, she goes to the attic. The lights don't work. Horror movie, of course, the lights don't work in the attic, so she has a candle and she's just going down the hallway with the candle, right? In any other movie, we would not be scared. If it was Jennifer Aniston in a comedy and she's going down the hallway with a candle, we don't care. But because we're in a horror movie, we are worried and we have dread.
Right.
And I thought that is so true. We set ourselves up, and so much in horror is how you mentally prepare for it, or how you are being manipulated to it. You know, we talked about, you know, cutting off the frame, you know, only letting the audience see a little bit. You don't have these big expansive shots because you want things to jump in from the sides, or nobody know. I can't see my peripheral.
Right.
You know. Anyway, I just thought it was very fascinating to look at two people who obviously hate the genre and how they try to appreciate it, you know, sort of thing.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this in the past. I mean, you can't do, you know, action or sci-fi, really, without money. You can do a drama, but dramas don't usually attract people.
Very niche.
Horror movies tend to attract. Yeah, I mean, so it's always been, I mean, for years, like decades. I mean, even George Romero back in the 60s knew this. That's why he did it, I'm sure.
Makes sense.
Because he could do it on the cheap and potentially become not necessarily famous, but attract attention to get money for future projects.
Yeah, and we've talked too how, you know, eras spawn different variations of horror. You know, I think this season especially, I like the fact that we've covered so, I mean, we went back to, what, Dracula, the 30s? Yeah. You know, and look at the difference between that and, like, you know, today or whatever, you know, different horrors. And
well, and today's a total mishmash of everything.
Yeah.
Or at least two things. Yeah.
Yes. But they take the context, but they still have the same premises. And we still go into them with this, ooh, hand me my popcorn. I'm getting ready to just jump, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Really cool.
Well, that being said, I guess we could easily segue into today's topic.
Yeah, since we're all horror.
Kind of, yes, and we were talking about making horror movies and really first films. And this is kind of a first film for him. He did television as well as short films, but I think this was his first big film. And we are talking about a little movie that came out in 2009, and it was directed by a man named Ty West, and it is called House of the Devil. The title alone attracts me.
It should, yes. I could.
It's a very exploitive 1970s title.
Right. I could understand that.
And this movie has a bit of a gimmick in that you could watch it and not realize it was made in 2009.
True.
Because it looks like it was filmed in 1980.
Oh, easily.
And this director went to painstaking lengths to create a film that looked like it was made in 1980. Ironically enough, he has a new movie coming out called X that is kind of a porno meets Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I don't know enough about it, but the trailer looks like it was made in the 70s, so I'm assuming he's doing it again.
Well, and you said 19, to me it doesn't look like 1980s, it looks like 1980. It looks like,
that's what I mean,
there are definite cinematic things that he does in this that are very 70s. Even that picture that you have, that title and that graphic and that font, that is so 70s.
And the freeze frame.
Yeah. Is so.
Because she is frozen there. She is not moving in that still.
Yeah. Yeah. For those of you listening, Tim is showing in his, on the YouTube channel, he is showing the title graphic from the movie. Mm-hmm. And it's basically, we have this, he sets up the whole movie with that though. But I mean, the title credits seems so long, and we're just watching one single solitary girl, the heroine, walk. But across every now and then she freezes, and the credit will come up. And then she'll keep walking, and then she'll freeze, and a credit will come up. And
it's very Charlie's Angels, or I mean, it's television of the time. It is movies of the time.
Oh, definitely.
It's just hilarious. I mean, so for me, and I'm assuming for you, and I will do the synopsis real quick. This movie is enjoyable on multiple levels, mainly that, though, the fact that you're like, oh my God, I remember that. Oh, look at the way he's shooting that. Oh no, extreme zoom, close up, now. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff.
Oh yeah.
Funny stuff. But basically, it's a very simple movie. It's one of those I like with a small story, small cast. There's a girl named Samantha. She has a horrible roommate in college that she, I mean, that is clearly set up. So she's looking for a place to rent. She doesn't have a lot of money. She's got her friend Megan, who is, I don't know, her support, you know, her only support really in the movie is her fraternal bond with this girl that she has a couple of scenes with. And she decides to take a babysitting job. Love that shot too, when she's walking by the bulletin board on campus and it zooms in and you see babysitter wanted and it's got the little tearaways with the phone number. She calls them. They don't call her back. Her friend goes and rips down all the posters so they won't have anyone else to call. They end up calling her, but there's a surprise twist. It's not really a job for babysitting a child. It's for babysitting an adult. An older mother-in-law of the Mr. Ullman. I jumped ahead just a bit, but she ends up meeting. Does she meet with him before? Yeah, she meets with him before she goes out there, doesn't she?
No, he calls and they set up
a
meeting.
She talks to him.
But then he never shows. And that's why her friend gets mad and takes all the things down.
Right. And then he calls and says he had someone else, but she didn't work out. I want you to do it, if you will. I'll pay double. And yep. Her friend ends up giving her a ride out there, and she finds out that it is not what she thought it was going to be. Her friend does not want her to stay, but he ends up offering her $400 because they have to get to this eclipse event.
Yeah.
Which is very telling if you've ever watched a devil satanic movie, what have you. And anyway, she ends up being dropped off at the house by her friend Megan mm-hmm. for 4 hours. And I'll just leave it there before we go any further on the plot.
Mm-hmm.
I have talked to you about this movie. I know you haven't seen it.
Mm-hmm.
Did it not blow your mind when you started watching it?
Yeah. I mean, literally, this came right off the shelf at Blockbuster, you know, all kind of with the sleeve and everything. I was going, okay, even if I disagree at times with some of his pacing and some of his storytelling, the style is totally noteworthy. It's amazing. It really is to recreate an era as well as he does. Down to like the tennis shoes and the cars,
the cups on the table,
yeah,
in the diner, yeah,
yeah. The only thing that threw me off as an anachronism was she has a water bottle, and I don't think they had water bottles with those accordionated straws in 1980.
You know, I looked at that too.
Think they did.
But it looks like one of those thermoses that's like that real thick plastic.
Well, and that's
what I thought
it was a thermos, but it wasn't, because she actually does the little top and pulls it off when she puts it in the water. But mm-hmm. other than that, I mean, the phone booth, props. I've got props noted all over. The rotary phone that's yellow, that's a princess phone that has a cord that's like 7 miles long, so you can go all over the house. That is so true. Oh my gosh. When she's looking around the house, that's where you get, you know, prop city, the harpsichord, the in the bookcase is an entire set of world book encyclopedias. One of my big things that I read cover to cover as a kid.
Oh, I used them to do book reports all the
Loved
time
it.
Or school reports.
You know,
yeah.
So, I think I was unfamiliar totally with Ty West. I was unfamiliar with most of this cast. I mean, I knew the shills. I knew like Tom Noonan. I knew Dee Wallace. But the mm-hmm. lead girl, I'd never seen her before in anything. The other girl.
You have.
Okay.
I'll tell you later.
Okay. But I think his direction and aesthetic and her performance really make this movie worth seeing, I think, to everyone. I did not find it scary in the least, but I find it a really great look at a genre, a subgenre of a genre, but definitely a dated period piece. This is like watching a restoration comedy, only it's horror, you know, for the time sort of
right.
thing. Yeah.
Well, I mentioned that this was his first film. He actually had a film come out the very same year that I'm not sure which came first, and it was a sequel to the Eli Roth movie, Cabin Fever. He did Cabin Fever 2, Spring Fever,
so there's,
which I have never seen.
There's more flesh-eating virus, and it goes...
I guess. Like I said, I've not seen it. And then in 2011, he did The Innkeepers, which I think I saw... But I don't remember it, so I can't remember if it was any good. And then he did a segment of the anthology film VHS, which is ironic because this looks like a VHS. So he doesn't have a lot of experience. However, with television and these, he did everything. So he, you know, that's why you see him. He is the editor of this movie, as well as the director, as well as the writer, and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's definitely, this is all Ty West all the way mm-hmm. through this. And I, like I said, I had never heard of him before. I would be curious, and I didn't do a lot of research, but I would be curious to see what the reaction of modern horror fans is to this movie. Because this
Agreed.
Is not the aesthetic of modern horror at all.
And I have a reverse flip I'll throw at you. if you were watching this movie in the 80s, would you have been bored?
No, I don't think so.
No?
Because, well, possibly.
Because it we love it because of nostalgia, but in a way, it's kind of slow.
It's very slow. Oh, no, kind of. I mean, I don't think there's any action until like 70 minutes into it or something.
Right.
You know? I mean,
it's there's a lot of suspense, though.
Well, and that's the only thing, that, you know, again, like I said, the aesthetic, I praise him wholeheartedly for it. Storytelling, eh, not so much. It is very 80s, but I think he missed a huge opportunity in that slow, it's like a 15-minute sequence of just her in the house exploring, you know, which was kind of pseudo-suspenseful kind of. If there had been a little bit more clues or hints or somethings in that, I think it would have been better. Like, there was a time where she comes down, she plops down on the sofa, we cut to outside the window looking at her. And it's one of those typical, he didn't use any long lenses in this movie. Everything is a short lens and they zoom in either slowly or, you know, moderately, whatever, which is a very late 70s, early 80s style, which is great. But there are a couple of those where all of a sudden it does this kind of thing. And does almost that John Carpenter wave kind of thing or movement. And you kind of think, oh, that's somebody watching her. Probably the dude with the gun, you know, kind of thing. If he had done a little bit more of that, or let me put it this way. My notes, and I totally agree with everyone when I read back through them. If Mike Flanagan had done this, it would have been terrifying. Because he would have found a way to make her exploration of that house scary and build. Because he does that so well.
Right. Because the main thing that happens during that, that's the reveal, is the picture of the prior owners of the house in front of the van. And then later, she, excuse me, she almost opens a door.
To their bodies.
Where their bodies are. Yeah. That should have been the climax. And Mike Flanagan would have probably built up more to that.
Yeah.
Scares. Yeah.
And had just a little bit more of this, you know, we would have been more suspicious of the pizza guy rather than after it. You know what I mean? We would have been, don't open the door. Oh, it's the pizza guy. No, it's not. Don't trust the pizza guy, you know, or whatever.
But she doesn't. She throws the money at him and slams the door in his face.
Yeah. It says, and then turns
love
it upside
that,
down.
But, I love when, I think she's going up the stairs. I can't remember. She's going somewhere creepy when that doorbell rings, and it is the loudest, obnoxious doorbell.
Oh, she's all the way upstairs getting ready to open the attic door.
That's what it is.
And it goes, yeah. So it was a great jump scare, audio jump scare. It was good.
Yeah, it's a great jump scare.
Well, what about you? Had you seen this before? What about the first time you saw it?
The third time I've seen it. Yeah, I watched it back when it came out because I had been reading, praise about it. And then I watched it a couple of years ago when trying to research movies for the podcast, and I was like, yeah, we need to do this
one. Yeah.
There's a lot going on in this movie.
I mean, this whole movie looks like it's shot on 16 millimeter. I mean,
it is shot on 16 millimeter.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. I did.
Yeah. I was waiting for you because you're the one that always knows these tech things. I thought you knew that.
No, it looks like 16 millimeter. So that makes sense now that it actually was. I was thinking, wow, what lensing and film did he use to actually create that? But
I've got a few stats. It was a $900,000 budget. It was shot on 16 millimeter.
Jesus.
And it took 18 days to film.
$900,000 in 2009? Wow.
I mean, it's like the equivalent
he didn't
of
pay,
Sam Raimi or John
He didn't
Carpenter.
Pay anybody.
No. And Dee Wallace only was there for one day.
Well, that makes sense. She's only in one scene. Come on.
Yeah, but, true.
I mean, Noonan could have done his, except for the finale. He could have probably done his in a day, too.
Right.
But that's interesting. Then that makes a lot of sense why he chose what he chose, because there are lighting choices he made that I thought were weird sometimes, but very true to 16 millimeter. you know, where people are like in silhouettes and you're just getting a key light because you only have one light. Or like you go into a room and turn on a lamp and it really doesn't light the room at all. It just kind of lights the lampshade.
Right. And that's one reason why I'm so glad that we were talking about this before we segued into it, because this is kind of like the movie that somebody's trying to prove themselves with to get in the genre.
Oh, true. True.
You know,
if Ari Aster is trying to prove the folk thing or whatever, and he's trying to prove this aesthetic that I can tell these aesthetic stories. Yeah.
Right. Or Robert Eggers with The Witch.
With The Witch.
Same thing.
Yep.
He had a little more of a budget probably for costumes. But I love this movie. It's not a perfect movie. It's got some big gaping plot holes really in the end. But it's still, I love that they're trying to capitalize on what we grew up with in the 80s known as satanic panic.
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, one of the podcasts I listen to is True Crime, and they're always talking about the, you know, the Memphis Three and everything else, and that whole, you know, especially now, because that's getting new press, because they're probably going to exonerate those boys who have been in prison for almost 30 years because of a corrupt cop, and getting the whole town thinking they're Satanists. They wear black. That boy has black hair over his eye. He must be a Satanist. You know, kind of thing. Yeah, it was huge.
And he really just likes The Cure.
Huge in the 70s. Yeah. But yeah, and that stuff. Again, that's another miss I think he did. You know, he does this really cool thing, which was late 70s, early 80s, with all the exposition comes from, well, first has a little crawl or a little prologue with the sentences, you know, based on a true story kind of thing, even though we never hear about any true story that's based on, but you know, all the information comes from television or radio. We hear about the eclipse. We hear about, you know, the horror, the Frightmare show that's on tonight or whatever. Maybe hearing something satanic or, you know, pigs were mutilated nearby, or, you know, something like that might have helped, I think, to keep that mm-hmm. thread going all the way through it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like something that was in the paper that she could have seen while she was at the diner.
Or looking up the apartment, she suddenly just shows a headline of, you
like
know,
a headless corpse picture. Yeah.
Or cemetery desecration or something. You know,
right,
the way they
right.
do. And it just, I think there were a few misses in there because we are so set up for that last act, and then it's not as good as we expected. It's gory, which is great, but it's not as good as what we were expecting.
No. As a matter of fact, I will go ahead and finish the plot with folks.
Yeah.
She takes the job. Her girl, much to her friends to not wanting her to take it, and she agrees to pick her up at 12:30. Well, the friend drives off, and this is one of the dumb things, is she's going to light a cigarette, but she decides to pull into the cemetery to light the cigarette, and a guy lights the cigarette for her. So who's hanging out of the cemetery?
Yeah.
And he ends up shooting her. So her friend's dead. So whenever she calls her friend and gets the answering machine while she's house-sitting, so to speak, she just gets an answering machine. We know she's dead, but she doesn't know she's dead. And
yeah,
it gets more and more.
And two great touches there. One, blowing her head off the way he does is just,
wow,
holy hell, that came from nowhere. And that was a great jump scare. That was great and great effect, too. And the touch of reaching over her body, taking the cigarette from her hand and smoking it.
Yeah,
it
taking her lit cigarette and smoking it was really sick. Yeah.
And then, like you said, the answering machine, her message, the fact that it was a fake hello that we used to all do when we had answering mm-hmm. machines. You know, hello? Sorry, wrong. We're not here.
Yeah, no, we're not here.
Just to fuck with people. That it was so true. And it was got so frustrating that she had to listen to it every time.
Every time.
Yeah. Love it. Sorry to interrupt. Those were good
points.
Oh, no,
you're fine. Anyway, there's suspense with her in the house. That house is pictured behind me right now. And ironically enough, we have a house on our main street that looks almost identical to that house. I call it a gingerbread house.
There's one in Morristown. It's the same way. I call it the yeah. Yeah, it's definitely an old school Gable. It's like House of Seven Gables kind of house. Yeah.
Yeah, very creepy looking. Anyway, before Almond and his wife, we meet his wife, who's very creepy too, to go to their, what is it, their eclipse event.
Because everyone dresses up in furs for an eclipse event.
Right, and weird wigs. He says there's a number for a pizza delivery on the refrigerator and an extra $20 if she gets hungry. And so she utilizes it, and we realize, oh, wait a minute, that may not be an actual pizza delivery. And it's the guy that shot her friend in the cemetery. But she basically just grabs the pizza from him, throws the money at him, and slams the door.
Okay, where did he get the pizza?
Oh, I figured that he just went and picked one up.
But she called him. So you're saying he went and got the pizza and then
came out. He just went somewhere and picked up a pizza and then doped the pizza, because later on we realized she's been drugged. She only ate like a half a piece, but it knocked her out.
See, I didn't think that, because it was interesting because she has that one line earlier where she says, I get disoriented sometimes. And I thought that. I didn't think she'd been drugged. That was interesting.
I don't even remember that line.
Yeah, she has this. She stood up and she got real dizzy and she sat back down and she goes, I get disoriented sometimes. And so I thought the stress had caused her to pass out. Not that she was drugged, but that's interesting either way.
Well, she only eats like half a slice and then she throws it back down like it tastes terrible.
Yeah.
And they show like a little brown thing in the sink or something. I was like, is that a? I couldn't tell what it was. I was like, what is that? Right. Anyway. So as she starts finding out what's going on, she ends up passing out. And then she wakes up, and it's like my key right here is Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, yeah.
Because they do those flashes, you know, like six consecutive flashes of a candle or six consecutive flashes of her lying there with a gag in her mouth.
Yep.
And she is to be the sacrifice. She is going to carry the Antichrist into the world or whatever. But of this very small little Satanist group of this Mr. Allman and Mrs. Allman and their son with the gun. So it's a very little small cult.
The Allman family cult. Yeah.
Exactly. And she ends up fighting. She's a great final girl, I guess you'd say. Ends up killing almost all of them. Allman chases her outside and hints that she was chosen or what have you, and she starts to realize that he's right, and she puts the gun to her head and kills herself, supposedly. And then there's a little
coda.
Yeah, a little coda of her in the hospital surviving the gunshot wound and the nurse telling her that she's fine, that they're both fine, and she is pregnant.
Right.
Very 70s.
Yes. Very 70s. It was interesting because I didn't get the whole baby thing. I got she was going to be sacrificed is what I
did
thought.
Too.
Even though grandma was... Well, you know, mutated grandma was pouring something into her.
Oh, I forgot about her. There's a third. A fourth, I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, because we have mutant grandma. But then later on she says the transformation's already started. So I thought, oh, she's going to be changed into a demon. Sort of thing. But then at the very end, nope, she's got a baby. And there's no freaking... We saw literally her head blow out the other side.
I know. I was like, there's no way she survived
There's no way she survived
that. I mean, there are freak incidents where people try to kill themselves and don't die, but I just don't see it in that circumstance.
No, I mean, literally, it was a great makeup effect. I mean, it blew her head off. And there's no way, just some bandages and, oh, you're okay.
You're okay. Well, maybe she's not okay. Maybe they're just keeping her body alive till the baby's born.
Well, see, and again, could have fixed that with one line. Where instead of the nurse saying that, you'll be fine, it should have been, you know, we're going to keep her alive until the baby's born. Dun, dun, dun. And then
we can't save you, but we'll save the baby.
Something like that. Oh, yeah. There you go. That's good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Call up Ty. Let him know.
So I gave. Now we know the story. I want to go back again to what we were talking about with the way this movie is made.
Yes,
It is obviously a nostalgic piece, and obviously from a different time, technique-wise.
Oh, God, yeah.
What do you think it says about how horror movies should be made?
I think...
Do you think this is saying this type of movie is better than some of the crap we watch now? Or do you think there's room for both?
I don't think he takes a statement on that. I think he's showing a different aesthetic and a different approach and everything else. And the fact that, you know, we've talked about it several times, I think, this season about slow burn, a slow burn process for horror. And a lot of modern horror audiences don't like that. But then they'll mention things like The Conjuring or Paranormal Activity or all those. And those are slow burn movies.
Yeah.
They go back to this genre or this subgenre of an obvious protagonist, singular hero story fight. And it's very slow in developing. It's not, we're going to have a hook in the very beginning. We're going to kill three people and then we're going to go, you know,
it's not as formulaic, I guess, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, I think modern...
I mean, it has a formula, for sure.
But I think modern movies are formulaic, too. They're just formulaic at a much faster pace, and it's usually a much more frenetic, action-oriented horror approach.
I think that modern is more... more jigsaw puzzle. It's like, oh, this piece goes here, this piece goes here.
Yeah.
Whereas this is a little more freeform.
Well, it's like I said, I think modern horror is much more influenced by action and torture porn and puzzles than it is by the aesthetic and the feeling. That's why I think Flanagan is so incredibly good.
Well, that's why I loved Hereditary.
Because he goes back to this. He goes back to, you know, Midsommar, we talked about, you know, a couple of seasons ago, is another slow burn thing where we know something's going to happen. We just don't know what. And when it finally happens, you go, oh, my God. Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
And that's an homage, I think, back to this era, too.
Agreed.
You know, if it's 79, 80, so this is... After Halloween, is this after Nightmare on Elm Street?
1980 is the same year The Fog came out.
Okay.
If that gives you reference.
Okay, so so it is in that time period of...
like When a Stranger Calls.
Which is one of my keys, you know, of course. Which is that whole aesthetic of a... trying to think of a word for it.
And it's funny. I did mean the year 1980 because this does have more 70s elements than 80s elements.
Oh, yeah. Even the aesthetic behind you. Look at that paneled wall with that horrible landscape painting that Grandma always has above her floral print.
There was one in my basement where we used to watch movies.
Yeah, that is the late 70s. That's that era.
Right.
The red lampshade, all of that. So, I mean, great aesthetic, great look. Yeah, I do think, I don't think he's saying go back to this. I think he's saying appreciate this as a different kind of meal sort of thing. This is a different approach to horror.
Well, I will say that Ty West looks like a young guy. And I think it's funny that he's paying homage to these films that were probably before he was born. And if his next movie, X, is truly set in the 70s and looks like a 70s film, he's going even further back.
Well, look at Stranger Things. I mean, the brothers have put together this incredible 80s homage that is very... but they're more mid to late 80s. In their style than this. This has a lot of Rosemary's Baby, that Polanski approach, all of those auteurs of the 70s. And he's an auteur, totally. He wrote, directed, edited. Right. You know, the 70s was huge for auteurs. I mean, Coppola is telling his movie. Scorsese is telling his movie in Taxi Driver. And it's all of, you know, they're involved in every aspect. And you can feel that in this. She's just outstanding in this. The lead actress is just really good.
I love her. And if we want, we can move on to casting. Because I did have some...
Oh, yeah. You're going to tell me I've seen her before. I don't think I've seen her before.
Well, her name is... she's Samantha in the movie. Her name is Jocelyn Donahue. And you last saw her in Doctor Sleep. She plays Abra's mother. So Flanagan has already hooked on to her.
His mother.
Yeah, remember her parents get killed by the what's that cult called? The Loose Knot or something?
Yeah.
Not True Knot.
True Knot.
I think it is. Yeah, remember Danny goes and gets Abra with the Indian Alcoholics Anonymous friend of his. I can't remember his name. I think he's Indian. He's the guy from another Flanagan movie.
Yes.
Midnight Mass. Wasn't he in Midnight Mass too?
No, I think he was in Outsider. Wasn't he in Outsider?
Oh, I'm confusing him with the guy in Midnight Mass. I'm sorry. He was on. He was the guy that was on Fear of the Walking Dead first season.
Okay.
Anyway, that's irrelevant. They go to get Abra, and they have to convince Abra's parents to let them take her because they're two adult men taking a small girl because they're going to find that baseball kid's body buried out.
Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah.
But what happens is the True Knot apparently goes there after they go there and kills them. So they don't have big parts, but they play Abra's parents.
Huh,
or they. Okay. I say they because there's a guy, obviously. But this woman, Jocelyn Donahue, is the mother.
Okay. Yeah, I don't remember her from that, really.
Yeah. But. Well, it was a small part, but I just wanted to say that Flanagan had to have noticed her from something. I think Flanagan saw this movie and said, I'm going to use her in something. Because he is great at casting.
Oh, my gosh. And I love the fact that he's got his group. And and he's continuing it. I love that.
Ty may want to take a note of that. I also would like to just point out, just from my own point of view, she looks like Jacqueline Smith in some scenes. Oh, my God, she looks like Jacqueline Smith.
Especially when she has this, you know, in the continuity, when she has the semi-curls. Just right here, just the half curls. Well, and it's interesting. Her friend looks like Farrah Fawcett. She has the Fawcett.
She has the wings. Yeah, the butterfly or whatever they call those things back in the 70s.
Yep,
yeah, definitely. And her roots are showing. Her hair's a little shorter, but I could see that. I just thought she looked like Jacqueline Smith because of the length of her hair, the style of her hair, her face. And then, of course, if you're heterosexual out there, you would have noticed her rear end in those tight jeans.
What? I didn't see anything.
Sure. So anyway, that's Jocelyn Donahue. Next on the list would obviously be Mr. Tom Noonan.
Yes.
Tom Noonan is a huge personal favorite of mine. He plays Mr. Allman, which by any coincidence, the only Allman I've ever met was in The Shining.
That's my key. Yeah. The only Allman I've ever heard or read about was Mr. Allman. So.
Tom Noonan is a great character actor, and I know him from two things in particular. Do you?
Well, he will always be Dollar Hyde to me. He will always be Dollar Hyde from Red Dragon.
Okay.
Because he was just so creepy, but good creepy. He is such, he's not a Brad Dourif who you immediately look at and go, oh my God, this guy's crazy.
Well, that's, Dourif overplays, Noonan underplays.
But just the way he counterpoints it, he is such a nice looking gentleman, and then, but he has this quirkiness to him, and you're going, uh-oh. Something ain't right.
No. You know? I mean, the minute I see him on screen, I think something's not right before he utters a single word.
Yeah, it'll always be Dollar Hyde. Always.
Well, and the reason for that is because he also plays serial killers, and he played one of my favorite serial killers in one of my favorite X-Files episodes called Paper Hearts.
Ooh, okay. We haven't covered that one yet, have we?
We haven't. It's season 3, I believe.
Okay.
And he collects little swatches of fabric from girls' pajamas in that one. I just won't say anymore.
See? They all do kind, nice gestures like that.
Oof.
You know, little
so,
trophies.
Yeah, Tom Noonan is a creepy motherfucker, and when you see him in this, you automatically know, oh, this is no babysitting gig.
Well, just, you know, and I'll compliment Ty West on this, the writing of the two phone calls is creepy. Just his voice and the way he's, I'm so sorry. Things were just so crazy here, and I couldn't get there. But I'm really desperate, you know. And you're like, I don't know. This guy's kind of creepy sounding.
I'll give you another $100.
Yeah. Yeah.
400.
Okay, we really 400. Need someone.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very high-paying babysitting gig. $400 oh, and yeah. a pizza.
In 1980? And then she's listening, and upstairs you hear him say, she's perfect. And you're thinking, it could be totally innocent. Also could be, holy, this is creepy. Sort of thing, yeah. Well, yeah, he's great. He's really good.
Let's add to the creepiness and talk about Mary Warnery. I think that's how you pronounce it. Worony. Warnery. Who plays Mrs. Ullman.
Yeah, she's
his
creepy.
Wife.
Yeah, she was creepy too.
Did you recognize her?
No.
I think Ty West is just he must just study films of the 70s.
He
and
might.
Look for people. But she is a B-grade genre movie actress, very much like, you know, Sybil Danning or Sandahl okay. Bergman. And she was in Death Race 2000.
Oh, yeah.
With David Carradine.
David Carradine, baby.
And she was also in some other genre ones that we're familiar with from the 80s, including Night of the Comet and Warlock with okay. Julian Sands.
Okay.
So, very familiar-looking face.
Yeah, she had a creep factor to her. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a kind of a one-note character that she played, but it was good. It was fine.
Yeah.
It added to the creep factor of him, which worked.
I thought so, too. I thought they paired really well. And they're not in many scenes, and they steal them. I mean, you just immediately go to their face.
Well, you've got an interesting picture, too, going, you know, popping to aesthetic for just a second. When, as a director, you can make several choices, you know, of course, or hundreds of choices, but one of those is angle of sight. So where how high the camera is. This movie is shot almost all from the chest of whatever character is in it. So everything is looking up almost exclusively. Even like when they're sitting at the booth, she and her best friend, they're having the pizza at the pizza place. They could have framed that with their eye line. But they don't. They frame it lower, kind of just a hair looking up. And when Newton's in the shot, they really shoot up to emphasize how tall he is
he
and
is
bigger
very tall.
And everything else. But like even with her there, you notice we're about level with her chest, kind of looking that way. It's very interesting. He does that the entire movie. Like we're almost in the seat beside her when she's smoking that cigarette before he appears in the window. Everything is not profile straight on. It's real low looking up at her. And I thought that was a really cool choice because it makes us feel uncomfortable. We don't like being below
people. I can think of a couple of instances right now. One, I want to say they focus on her tennis shoes when she's walking and then sometimes move up to show her.
Yeah.
And then another one that is kind of jarring is when they're riding out to the house, they're talking, and then all of a sudden it's like the camera's in the floorboard of the back seat looking up at them.
Yeah. And she's looking like, back and she does her little Yeah. It's very unique choice, and I think it adds to our uncomfortableness as viewers because we don't like being below looking up feeling weak. You know, we like being on the same eye line with people.
Because we're omnipotent.
Yes. We're watching this ourselves.
Speaking of the Megan, her friend, she was played by Greta Gerwig. I don't have any information on her. She's a relatively young actress like Miss Donahue.
Yeah, she was fine.
However, A.J. Bowen, who played the son with the gun, is an art house actor of a lot of horror films, including Your Next, The Signal, and Sacrament. Some of these are on our list. I've not seen. I think I've seen Your Next. I've not seen The Signal or Sacrament.
Okay.
We'll come back to that. We'll move on to Dee Wallace. She is our beloved genre actress from E.T., Cujo, The Howling, Critters, and every other 80s movie that came out, pretty much.
She gets to turn into a cute little kitty werewolf at the end of The Howling.
At the end of The Howling, yes, she does. She does. Obviously, that was a good grab for him. I'm not sure how much he had to pay her, but he got her for a day.
Well, I think between her and The Fix, the music for her to dance around on, that's probably the most expensive things he paid in this movie.
There's one other 80s tune in there, too, and I can't remember what it was. Oh, well. But that was, you know, to establish the setting.
Yeah.
And then one other actress that we don't see very much of, unless she's having sex, is the roommate. And she was played by Heather Robb. She is a genre actress also. She was in Stakeland, The Roost, also with Tom Noonan, and Sacrament, also with A.J. Bowen. So you've got a little bit of a connection here between some of these actors and maybe the director. I don't know. Maybe he edited those films. I have no idea.
Maybe Ty's doing the same thing that Flanagan is and trying to develop his cadre of...
I have to say, I loved the casting for this movie. I thought the casting was one of its strong points.
Yeah. Yeah. I think every member's strong in it. You know, even stupid dude who's sleeping with her roommate who doesn't even have a line. He just says that.
Is that dopey grin? Yeah.
And it kind of says, hey, you're next. And it kind of bothers you. Yeah.
Does that not put you back into college dorm?
Oh, my God. Seeing the sock on the door, I was going, oh, my God.
I know. And just as soon as she's, like, tiptoeing around all the dirty clothes on the floor, there's a guy and a girl in the bed just 3 feet away from her. I'm like, oh, I do not miss that shit at all.
No. It was very, very dorm feel.
You felt for her. You're like, oh, no wonder she's looking for a place to move that she never got to move into, obviously.
And it adds to her desperation, you know, of getting out. Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah.
So true.
As far as awards, the film didn't win any major awards. It was nominated for a few subsidiary, like obscure ones. Our friends over at the Saturn Awards nominated it for Best DVD Release. It was nominated for the After Dark competition at the Chicago International Film Festival. And then Fangoria noted Tom Noonan for supporting and score. They gave it something for the music. They didn't give it to it. They were nominating it for those two.
Music was good. Yeah. Music did very well. It had its own little moody kind of piano piece with orchestra underneath, so it was nice.
Yeah. And this movie is not on the 1001 movies you must see before you die. But I would say, honestly, if you're a film student, you should watch this movie.
I think. Definitely. I would definitely think this should be taught. And if you are a cinephile or you appreciate genres of film, you should definitely watch this movie.
Yeah. From a crafting aspect, this is a must see. And it's one of the reasons I put it on the list, because I knew David would love it just for that aspect.
The aesthetic alone. Well, let me ask you, how did you feel about the gore? Did you like the gore in this? At the end?
I'm with you. I thought it was done pretty well. I mean, when he blows her head off in that car, man, it looks real, and you are not expecting it.
Yeah, and then gets in, and you see it all over the windshield and everything else, and then reaches over, and her hand is bloody that's holding the cigarette, and he takes, you know. And then all the stuff at the end, the stabs work, the eye gouging works, the great blood. It's very realistic.
Them running blood. And slipping in the blood.
Yeah, was a nice touch.
All of that stuff. And when the one thing I did notice that kind of took me out for a second is she's in some kind of white sacrificial gown, and at times it almost looks solid red. And I was like, it wouldn't be solid red.
Yeah, there was times when she went from being wearing white, smattered with blood, to it looked solid red. And then suddenly she runs outside and it's back white again.
It's back to white with a little red on it. Yeah. So
I also had issue, just me, but, you know, those are obviously the loosest ropes anyone could ever have on anyone, because she basically slaps grandma, and then she gets out of all four ropes. And nobody stops her, and she runs away. And I'm like, okay, needed something more there.
My rationalization was maybe they thought she ate more pizza. I don't know. She didn't need a lot of the drug pizza.
Yeah. No. And what was up with grandma? We never found out story of grandma or whatever, but she's not pretty.
She's not right, man. She looks, I mean... The first time I saw this movie, when I went back to watch it a second time, I had forgotten it. And I kept thinking, oh, yeah, it's like Phantasm. There's this weird mutant-looking thing in it. But now I realize it's not really a mutant. It's just the grandmother. She's old and kind of deformed and witchy-looking.
She's definitely deformed. Yeah.
Yeah. She's got a weird facial structure. Like, her brow and nose are all the same level.
Well, yeah, the prosthetics are very elephantitis kind of thing.
Yeah, and sunken eyes.
It reminded me, one of the keys I had was Buffy. It looked like a Buffy villain.
Oh, you know, okay, cool.
It looks exactly like a Buffy kind of thing. I thought, I think it's a miss there. I would have had a little bit more of the ritual so we could have understood a little bit more. You know, because I got confused. I got, okay, because Grandma cut herself, poured it into the skull, then poured it into her mouth. And I'm thinking, is Grandma going to be born through her? Mm-hmm. Is that what they're doing? Or are they bringing a demon to life? What are they doing?
I don't know. It was one of those things where I could ride the line of somewhat enjoying the ambiguity of it all. You know what I mean? Because sometimes I like that, not knowing everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm with you on some of the teases, though. Like, I think they could have teased it early on with, like, a missing person or something in a newspaper, that kind of thing.
Yeah, something to that effect. Or yeah. We're still looking for the family that disappeared in the woods. That might have been an interesting one, because then we...
had to have been that, because really there's only one eclipse, so they wouldn't have killed somebody else for the sacrifice. They just killed the folks for the house. So it would have probably had to be about the family.
Right. It would have had to have been more about them. I agree with that. You know,
I
also just struggle with some of the weirdness of that whole last ending stuff. But
I have a key for that.
Yeah,
and you're going to agree, I think, completely.
Okay,
it is so Rob Zombie. I was like, they're leading up with all this slow suspense, and then flash, 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 Texas Chainsaw Massacre, flash, 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 Rob Zombie. We're in another world of total horror. You know what I'm saying? And
yep. That's
kind of what Zombie does. I think this movie's better than a zombie movie, though.
Oh, God, yeah. He could learn a lot from this movie, actually, about how to do it. Okay, but I do have a question. Was I missing a scene? Because I went back and said maybe it was in a cut that I did. Because she goes over to the corner. She gets away from the magic ropes. She goes over the corner. The son comes over toward her. She gouges his left eye out. She runs upstairs. They all say, get her, get her, get her. You know.
And Mom, two people, her and the mother, walk by that gun and don't pick it up, which drives me crazy.
Right. Mom ends up going upstairs. She ends up stabbing Mom.
Mm-hmm.
Then she goes downstairs. She gets the gun. She runs outside, and Dad comes out stabbed.
Yeah.
Did I miss a scene where he got stabbed?
Yeah, it's very quick. But when she gets up off the table and pushes her way out, he's holding like a sacrificial knife. And I guess she rams it into him when she rams into him. That's the only thing I could figure.
Okay, that makes sense, because I didn't rewind that far. But then when we don't rewind. Anyway, in the 80s we rewound. So, yeah. but when she goes upstairs, Grandma's hurt still. And it shows Noonan and he's going, like he's in pain. So that makes sense now, because I thought, oh, I'm hurting because I was right in the middle of the ritual and you broke it. But instead, no, you kind of kicked the knife into my gut.
No, because he pulls it out and it's bleeding on the concrete. You see
But that's when he goes outside later on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
So he's wounded. Then she ends up gouging the son. And does she shoot him or stab him? She stabs him, right? I can't remember.
Yeah, she ends up stabbing him. She cuts his throat.
Yeah,
she has the longest arm in the world, because she is laying on the ground. He's got a gun on her, and she cuts his throat.
Yeah, she slings with a wide arc and slashes his throat.
Sure she did. But it gave
us all that blood for her to slip on later.
Yeah. Good effect, good slippery blood.
Yeah.
All that worked for me.
But she doesn't get the gun, which bothers me. She goes upstairs. The mother sees the son and is really sad. And then she goes upstairs and doesn't get the gun either. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Yep.
So she ends up killing the mother, running back downstairs, and finally picking up the gun. And that's because she's going to end up shooting herself with it in the end.
Right. Right. So. Which was a great touch. That I loved. I love that as a thing. He's going, you can't stop it. Da 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 da. And she goes, oh yeah, I bet I can. You know, and that was nice.
I was like, damn, you've just been trying to fight for your life, but now you're just going to shoot yourself?
Well, you have to do these things when you find out you have a devil baby in you, Tim.
Okay.
It's just, you have to do
it. And she could feel it. She was acting like she could feel something inside her, for sure.
Oh, so interesting. One of my last notes is this is the type of movie that Rob Zombie wishes he could make.
Yeah. And there are elements of it that are zombie-esque. But it's... You know, to me, the elements of a zombie film are very few and far between. So to sprinkle those elements into a film that is much better works. And I think it, you know, all the horror, it's like, here we are, act three, whammo. You know, let's throw it at them. Let's throw it all at the camera and go crazy now that you've been sitting here for an hour watching a woman walk through a house.
Yeah. Basically, room to room.
It's so creepy, though. The whole time I was watching it, just mesmerized.
And again, it could be little subtle stuff. Like, she goes in the bathroom twice, and literally nothing happens in the bathroom, except she does the psycho shot with the pull the curtain and sees the hair. But
and what was the hair?
I don't know. Grandma cut her hair off. Mom did.
I was thinking maybe they cut the hair of that family before they sacrificed them. I was like, what the fuck is all that hair?
They didn't ever explain the bathroom hair. Yeah, it's
ambiguous.
Sort of thing. Other than maybe mom was using that to make the wig that she wore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know. But he could have done little things like have something in a different place, which we as an audience would have noticed, but maybe she didn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It could be that subtle. That's a very Flanagan thing where open up the door and there's a hairbrush and a mirror. And then later on, she opens up the door and the hairbrush is moved and the mirror is not there. You know, just so you know, wait, I noticed it. Why didn't she? You know, it kind of, again, like we've said before, it puts us ahead of them. Right. And so now we're even more scared.
Right.
Kind of thing. I just think he could have done more of that. And I also think he could have really not put as much air in that syringe at the end. That's my last note of that freaked me out because that woman puts about an inch and a half of air in that syringe she pumps into her. And I went, a nurse would never do that. I mean, that's like embolism city. She's, you know, but anyway, we notice those things. Keys.
This movie is loaded with keys because this movie is a key in itself as far as being an homage to not only 80s horror movies that we know or 70s horror movies that we know, the ones we don't know. There's so many out there that I'm sure were similar to this.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of my biggest ones I actually mentioned was Rosemary's Baby. As soon as it started into the flashes and we see her there gagged and tied and everything else, I was going, oh my God, it's Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah.
It feels like it. And then when finally we get the idea at the very, very end, and both of you will be okay. I definitely got Rosemary's Baby.
That and The Omen. I was thinking The Omen.
Oh, Omen's a good one. Yeah. Omen's good,
A direct key, and this is because it's a low-budget movie and they couldn't afford the rights, is there's scenes just very much like Halloween.
Yep.
Where they're watching Night of the Living Dead on television. Yep. So there's two for one.
And, of course, all of the 80s babysitter movies. You know, When a Stranger Calls, Let's Scare Jessica to Death. You know, all of those are very 80s babysitters.
Yeah, for sure. Let's Scare Jessica.
I mentioned it, but I've got, you know, Psycho. It was a very Psycho feel when the hands going out real slowly to pull the curtain back. And then instead of looking, you go and tear the curtain. Like anybody does that. You know, the only time I do that is when anybody has a shower curtain closed because I can't take it. That's a pet peeve of mine.
People out there, you now know something I've known for 40-something years is that my friend David is terrified of closed shower curtains.
Why would you do that? There's no point. Nobody's in it. Why does it need to be closed? Unless you're a killer hiding on the other
side. I seem to remember a cast party where somebody purposely put like a bloody knife into a bathtub and closed it because they knew you would open it.
Like killers do. You know, you can't. It's not right.
We mentioned The Shining because of the almonds. I mean, that's just a very unique name, and I can't imagine that's a coincidence.
Yep.
One that I have that is very technique related is not only the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but the Amityville Horror, where it has the disclaimer at the front of the movie that says, during the 80s, there was a satanic panic. The events of this movie are true, blah, 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 blah. And you're like, wait a minute, did this really happen? And that's very much an homage to movies like Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Well, and a couple of the other, those exterior shots, too, of the house and her at night are very Amityville, because it's shot with that long lens up zoomed in, so it feels like, you know, we're outside in the yard voyeuristically watching her.
The house of the devil.
House of the devil, you know.
I love that title. I mentioned, like you said, Rosemary's Baby for slow burns, satanic scares.
Yep.
I mentioned countless movies of the 80s that we probably don't even know or ever saw.
yep.
There is one thing I did cop from IMDb, because I am not familiar with this movie, but there was an in joke, an 80s in joke when she's ordering the pizza. Did you know about this?
No.
Okay. When she calls to order the pizza, the guy laughingly says, would you like extra anchovies?
Yeah, I remember that, but I didn't know what that was a reference
to. It's a subtle nod to a movie with Patrick Dempsey called Loverboy. Where extra anchovies referenced that the delivery boy would be delivering more than pizza.
Oh, you need to use that in a romance novel. You should. Perfect for you.
That would be extra sausage. But extra. No. so, yeah, it was extra some stupid teen movie like Porky's that came out in 1989, actually, Loverboy with Patrick Dempsey. Apparently, extra anchovies means sexual favors.
Well, that's interesting because she says thank you at the end, and he says that real lascivious no, thank you, ma'am, you know, kind of thing at the end. I thought that's weird, but that's also when I triggered and went, oh, that's the son. That's why
he said actually, there's a pizza delivery on the refrigerator.
Yeah, actually, I thought that's the gun guy. I put it in my notes. That's the gun guy because I didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
The caretaker, whatever. I've got Flanagan, not just because of obviously homage and back and forth and aesthetic influences, but just the way of that sequence of her in the house. That's a very Flanagan thing. No dialogue, no nothing, but just her exploring the house.
Like Hush.
Yeah, and Hush, and also Hill House. Hill House does the same thing of showing the house itself as a presence. And I think he, again, a miss that he could have done. It's called The House of the Devil. We could have had a scarier house, I guess.
Right. Maybe. Because technically they just moved in. It's not really the house of the devil. It was the house of some dead people.
Yeah. Or it's, they had to have this house because in the basement, it really is the house of the devil or whatever, you know, it could have more.
Right. They could have had a red room with a little pig and a rocking chair or something. Yeah. Yeah.
Mr. Captain Howdy or whatever. Anyway.
Jody.
Jody was, that's Amityville, right? Jody.
Yeah.
Captain Howdy is Exorcist.
Yeah.
And then my last key is Buffy. Because Buffy had this entire thing with her college roommate and her didn't get along, which is a very trope of the time. Mm-hmm. You know, when Buffy went away to college, her roommate was the exact opposite. You know, she clipped her toenails and she chewed gum and she did all those things that roommates do that you don't like. And, you know, it was a very classic trope, I guess.
Yeah. I have no more keys. I do have one more trivia, though.
Yeah.
Self-proclaimed redneck film critic Joe Bob Briggs.
Joe Bob.
Has praised this film as just a superbly slow burn, extremely well-crafted movie. So there's one critic out there that likes this movie for sure.
Yeah, I think if you are of a mindset of Saw or Hostel or any of that, this would not be for you. But I think if you are of an appreciation of horror as a genre in and of itself, this is something to be studied. It's very, very well done.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's got our stamp of approval on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it fits in. It's not like, a few others we've had this season where you say, I wouldn't recommend this one. Not if you don't, not really. I think, go get a pizza while she's exploring the house if you want to. Mm-hmm. And come back and watch the end.
Yeah. Or whatever. Watch it with your friend when your parents are away.
Yeah. Just don't blow her head off.
Well, I think that does it then.
But yes, that definitely, we like House of the Devil. Go and watch more of it, I guess. Or more Ty West. I'm curious, we talk about influences and whatever. Obviously, he is someone to be reckoned with from an aesthetic. So I'll be curious to see this X, and I'll be curious to see what he does moving forward. Is he a Flanagan wannabe sort of, or a potential sort of thing?
Yeah, I can't wait to see this new movie, X. The previews alone reek of Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Interesting.
With a really, a porno twist. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
So, that's gonna wind us up for this.
Yes. We'll be all done.
We would like to thank you out there for listening to us. We are indebted to you.
Yes.
And
I mean, we don't do this just for ourselves, so that's like the thing. We're so
okay.
Tim's got the giggles now.
I have the giggles. If you're watching us on Patreon, if you're watching us on YouTube, please subscribe.
Yes.
That means hardly anything to you, but it means much to us.
Yes.
You can also ring that bell if you want notifications of when we have new shows up.
Which is usually every Monday.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. We have shows on Patreon that are both subscription-based and free. So if you'd like to see more of us, you can always go over there. And if you're interested in the X-Files or the classic Star Trek The Original Series, we have some subscription-based shows on them. Until next week, which I do believe will be back in science fiction land, I will be seeing you, David.
Yes, I'll see you then. We'll be sci-fying.
All right. See you. Bye.
Bye.